Minute break, and then we'll have the main speaker. The smoking area is located out in front, and the bathrooms are located down the hall to my right. The speakers this evening are being taped by Jess, and it will be posted to the St. Paul Intergroup website after the meeting sometime. The AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, organization, or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses or opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I have asked Dale to read How It Works from Chapter 5 of our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous.
Hi, everyone. Dale Alcoholic. How It Works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our story discloses in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures have availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandonment. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives have become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for his knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. The description of the alcoholic, the chapter of the agnostics, and the other personal and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. be that we that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and C, that God could and would if he were sought.
Thank you, Dale. I'm now pleased to introduce our first speaker this evening. Help me welcome Travis from Maine Idea.
Hello, my name is Travis. I'm an alcoholic. Some house cleaning stuff. I used to drink a lot. I have a home group. It's the Friday night happy hour group at Maine Idea. Used to spend my happy hours getting wasted. Now I get to spend them learning how to waste my life less. I have a sobriety date, September 18th, 2010. It's been a year and 2 months yesterday, so it's... It's been a very good year. My life is a lot different than it was even a year ago. As far as, you know, I was asked to share some experience, strength, and hope, and I was trying to figure out what it was that I'd share for a while, and really the best experience that I have is when I came here last year. It was my first AA function. I didn't even really want to come, but my sponsor had suggested strongly that I do. His home group was based off of the group that Clancy started, and he kind of explained who Clancy was and what he does, and basically he told me to take notes because he wanted a report, so I showed up. He told me to make sure I show up early so I get a seat, and I did. I showed up 45 minutes early, and it was standing room only at that time, and you know, as I was here, I got the feeling that I really didn't want to be here. There were so many people, and you know, it was like, I don't want to be here with these people, and then it would be like, you know, they look so happy, but then now what I know is that I've got this disease that allows me to feel worse than everybody in the room, better than everybody in the room, both at the same time, all while feeling completely alone, and if that makes any sense at all, you're probably sitting in the right chair. I had actually gotten to the point where before the meeting was going to kick off, I was getting ready to leave. I had actually picked up my bag and headed towards the door when I heard, "Hey, Travis," and I stop and I turn, and here's this guy that I recognized from a meeting. At the time, I didn't know his name. I knew where I knew him from, but, you know, he's, "Hey, we got a seat for you over here," you know. It was like the first time I was like, oh, well, somebody really reached out, and it was at this big place, and it was really kind of a cool deal. So I sat down, and I didn't go anywhere. And I remember the one-year speaker at that time, Liz. There was something about her energy, you know, that really appealed to me. And Clancy had some really good things to say. It was a kind of a bit of a long talk. He's kind of a cranky old coot, but he's got some good things to say about a lot of different subjects. And But really got me was at the end of the meeting. You know, this room was packed wall to wall. I mean, there was probably close to 500-600 people in here. And at the end, when we did the Lord's Prayer, you know, hand in hand, there was just this power that washed over me a little bit. You know, that's the first time I really felt the love of this program, I think, is being in a room of people, as I realized that they had more in common with me than I had realized at the time, you know. And it actually ended up being a really pivotal moment in my sobriety because last year at this time, if you remember, we had a freezing rainstorm this very night. And tonight I'm actually grateful it's just snow as last year, the day after our gratitude night, I broke my ankle while I was working step 3 and staying in a halfway house. If you want to talk about learning how to turn your will over to strangers, let alone God, break your ankle and learn how to ask people to wash your clothes and grab you food over and over again. That third step is a step that I don't have to learn the hard way again. I pray that stays with me. So a word to the newcomers, if you're new in this room, if you haven't heard it yet, you don't ever have to drink again. That's a good thing. And then, I don't remember what the second thing I wanted to say. But get yourself a sponsor, grab onto somebody that has something that you want. Take all 12 steps in order. I mean, what do you have to lose by taking however much time it takes to go from 1 to 12 through somebody else's, you know, somebody that's done it before? It's a valuable thing. And also something that I wish somebody had told me when I first got started is that there's nothing to figure out in this program. There's no way you can sit at the steps on the wall and figure out, well, hey, you know, oh yeah, inventory, that's great, or you know, making amends. There's only action to take. You can stare up the steps or you can step up the stairs. That's all there is to it. You know, there's nothing to figure out, only action to take. So if you're new, I pray that you can grab onto somebody that's got something good to show you and just hang on for the ride. There's a lot of people in this room that have more love for you than you realize. There's more in common in here than differences, and that's something that I wish I had learned right on. Thanks for allowing me to share, and with that, I'll pass.
Thank you, Travis. Gratitude Night reminds me how important service has been in my sobriety. I would like to encourage all AA groups to get involved with St. Paul Intergroup. One way to do this is to send a representative from your group to the main body meeting that's held the third Tuesday of each month at 7:30 in the lower level of Bethlehem Lutheran Church, which is across the street from the Spruce Tree Center, where the St. Paul Intergroup office is. The purpose of the meeting is to bring information and concerns from your group to Intergroup and to be able to take information back to your groups. Please see me after the meeting or contact the Intergroup office for more information. We'd love to see you all there. The next meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, December 20th. Alcoholics Anonymous is self-supporting through its own contributions. I've asked Judy to share with us tonight on this topic.
Hi, everyone. My name is Judy, and I'm an alcoholic. Larry. For those of you who I sponsor or those of you who have been in meetings with me when we recognize sobriety, one of the things that I tend to do is I tend to reflect and look back on the previous year. And so when I was asked to speak tonight, I did the same thing. And as I reflected back on my last year, this past year for me, there were three things that came to mind. The first thing that came to mind was this idea of personal responsibility. And what came to mind after personal responsibility is the responsibility statement. When anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there, and for that, I am responsible. And I was thinking about asking you to look at the person sitting next to you and ask yourself and reflect as to whether or not you could stay sober without that person in your life. And then think about St. Paul Intergroup. Intergroup cannot survive without your help. There's nowhere in the steps where it says I, it says we. And so we are collectively responsible for making sure that Intergroup's doors stay open. So yes, this is, I'm not gonna sugarcoat it. We are asking for money because this is, after all, Gratitude Night. And the second reflection was this: my reflection about gratitude. I have many things to be grateful for, and I would ask you also to reflect on your past year and the things that you have to be grateful for. One of the things I'm grateful for is Katie's here, and she's gonna speak tonight, and I don't get to see her too much anymore. And I also thought about action. And I opened up the daily reflections, and I was looking for something about action. And Bill wrote in As Bill Sees It, AA is more than a set of principles. It is a society of alcoholics in action. We must carry the message, else we ourselves can wither, and those who haven't been given the truth may die. So as you reflect on the gratitude that you have for the gifts that you've been given, I would ask you to put that gratitude in action. And There are ways to support intergroup other than just financially, and I was hoping that Frank would talk before I did so I could make some notes and tell you all about the good works that St. Paul Intergroup does. He's going to do that. And I know that this is challenging economically for many people, and so if you can't dig deep and support intergroup financially, I would ask you to consider supporting intergroup with your time and your talent, because that is just as important as any financial support that we can give. I was also reflecting back on the fact that 30 years ago, people put a dollar in the basket, and today, people still put a dollar in the basket. And yesterday, a friend of mine called me, and he said, "I'm at Big Top Liquors. I'm going to buy beer for the guys." Now, he's in the program, he's sober, but he was going to deer camp, and he always stopped to buy his friends beer for hunting weekend. So I asked him if he would tell me what the price of beer was, because it's been a long time since I've bought any beer. He called me back, and he said it was $17 for, I think, a 24-pack, and did you know that the state of Minnesota adds about a 10% tax on top of that? So I'm going to ask you that if whenever you had your last drink, if it was 20 years ago, if it was a year ago, if it was 5 years ago, consider contributing the cost of that 24-pack today to St. Paul Intergroup. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy. As we pass the baskets, I would like to introduce Frank, Intergroup office staff, who will tell us more about what Intergroup has to offer.
Good evening. My name's Frank, and I'm an alcoholic. For the past few months, it's been my pleasure and my honor to serve as a Tradition 8 special worker at Your St. Paul Intergroup. And although I've been involved as a volunteer in various capacities at St. Paul Intergroup over the last few years, it really has been an eye-opening experience for me as I've sat kind of at the center for the first time and seen exactly how many people are involved in making the mission of St. Paul Intergroup come to life on a day-by-day basis. And I want to share a bit of my gratitude on behalf of St. Paul Intergroup to all of you, to our area groups, and to the many hundreds of AA members in the St. Paul area who contribute their time and their experience, strength, and hope so that others may recover as well. And I'm going to go over just a few of the ways in which this happens every day and every week here in St. Paul. Our member groups, who originally formed a St. Paul Intergroup over 50 years ago, continue to participate in its activities by, as Judy mentioned, nominating and sending their group representatives to our monthly business meetings where they can participate in advising and supporting St. Paul Intergroup in its mission. By, of course, purchasing their literature and their medallions and their other supplies in our store. And, of course, through their generous Seventh Tradition contributions that they make to support us. And our members, individual AA members, also, of course, support us through their purchases in our store. And, by the way, we have some lovely holiday items for gift giving. But there's also many other ways in which they serve in order to further their own recovery. And it's been almost breathtaking at times to see how many people are so willing to devote their time to our mission. Of course, we have a long lists actually, one male and one female, of people who have volunteered to take 12-step calls any hour of any day. We also have a list of people who are willing to serve as temporary sponsors to people who are new to our program, new back to our program, or just new in town. and need a little bit of guidance in finding their way among our new community. We have a list of speakers who have volunteered to tell their story when groups have requested that a speaker be sent out for them. And I haven't counted, but there's hundreds of people on that list. We have many volunteers who answer phone as night owls when the office is closed during the evening hours, overnight hours, or in the early morning hours as early birds, so that our telephone number, 651-227-5502, is answered 24/7 by a volunteer in recovery in our community. And that's a testament to the volunteerism that we have in our own, in our fellowship here. We have many volunteers who also serve us by helping host events such as this one and our hospitality suites at Gopher State and at Founders Day and at the other activities that we do throughout the year. We have dozens, literally dozens and dozens of people who work in our office as volunteers, answering the telephone and helping get the lifeline and our other paperwork done, keeping the office clean, the shelves stocked. And it would be very difficult to continue running the office without them. We have volunteers who have contributed articles to our Lifeline newsletter, and you are all welcome to submit your own comments and articles for future issues. We'd love to see them. And I certainly can't go through the many wonderful volunteers that we have without mentioning that our website is maintained by a volunteer. And if you've ever looked around, if there's a better meeting directory online anywhere in the world, I don't think so. So thanks to that volunteer as well. Now, as I said, St. Paul Intergroup was formed over 50 years ago by area groups here in St. Paul to help the alcoholic who still suffers. And thanks to the continued and dedicated service of those groups and the many members that they have, we're able to continue the services that we do today, and I'm very grateful to all of you and to all who aren't here for your help in doing so. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. We will now take a 10-minute break. Out of courtesy for the next speaker, please be back in 10 minutes at 7:35. Thank you.
I didn't know if I was going to see the clock from here, so I have my phone. I promise I'm not texting. And I don't like microphones, so bear with me just a little bit. My name's Katie, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is, April 25th, 2002, I think. Yeah. So the lights are bright, too, so if it looks like I'm looking at you funny, that's why as well. I'm so grateful to be back in St. Paul. I moved here at about 3 months sober. I went to treatment in Oregon, and they shipped me here to our fun recovery community when I was about 3 months sober, and I've been in St. Paul until about a year and a half ago. And went to St. Louis, Missouri for grad school. So I'm back now visiting. I'm not coming back. Poor me. It's sad. But I had no intention of staying in St. Louis, none whatsoever, but it's worked out that way, just like I had no intention of staying in St. Paul when I moved here. I was in Portland, Oregon. I lived on the West Coast, grew up on the West Coast, and so to come to the Midwest when they shipped me here, I was thoroughly irritated by the whole prospect. But I remember that day they posed to me, I had three options. I could either stay in Portland, go to a sober house, I could move back in with my mother, or I could come to St. Paul, Minnesota, and I just put St. Paul, Minnesota on a shelf. I had no intention of coming here. And then I started talking to the people that I was involved with before I got sober, because, you know, when you're still new in sobriety, you still talk to those people. And, you know, the longer I stayed sober and the more I talked to them, kind of the crazier they got, if that makes any sense. And I, you know, it dawned on me, like, what in the world did I have left in Portland? I had a heroin addict boyfriend who was homeless. I was running from another guy, which I'll get into in a minute. And, you know, I mean, what I had no place to live. Like, what was I really gonna do? So when I went back into the group a week later, you know, he said, the director said, so how about going to St. Paul, Minnesota? And I remember being like, I'm going to have to pray for the willingness to be willing, to be willing, to be willing to think about it. And, you know, a week later, I said yes. And I came to St. Paul, Minnesota, and I got to begin my recovery here. So this place means a great deal to me. It's my home. It's where I grew up. I was 21 when I got sober, and I'm 30 now, which is weird, but I'm 30, and it's, you know, it's just where I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's where I learned how to be a human being. It's where I learned how to be in relationships with people, and just, like, live life. So it's an honor to come back here and talk to you guys about that. I'm going to start. I read something this morning because I was trying to think about what to talk about. I'm not a planner still, but at the same time, like, I can ramble. So I was trying to think about what to talk about. And I read something, and I'm not going to tell you where it's out of because it's not conference approved, but I'm just going to read part of it. I know, grr. But it says, I no longer try to escape life through alcoholism. Drinking built up an unreal world for me, and I tried to live in it. But in the morning light, the real life was back again, and facing it was harder than ever because I had less resources with which to meet it. Each attempt at escape weakened my personality by the very attempt. Everyone knows that alcohol, by relaxing inhibitions, permits a flight from reality. Alcohol deadens the brain cells that presides over our highest faculties, and we are off to the unreal world of drunkenness. AA taught me not to run away, but to face reality. Have I given up trying to escape life? And I was, you know, I've been sober 9 years, and when I look back over that process, you know, my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous has been funny. I have not done anything perfectly, and I have actually, you know, outright done what you're not supposed to do in sobriety. You know, but I've had a sponsor, and I've been involved, and I've had a little bit of safety net with you guys that have allowed me to just grow up and to make mistakes and to keep coming back. But this question, have I given up trying to escape life? And I think about that in before I got sober. From the time I was probably 5 or 6 years old, I did everything I could to escape life. I was in competitive gymnastics most of my younger years. And so I, you know, went to school half a day, trained in a gym, had contract physicians, the whole nine yards. And so how I learned how to deal with things was to stuff it. Was to take narcotics and just deal with it from a very, very early age. Like, that was my coping mechanism. When I quit that life, I was going into seventh grade. And did I bring my water? I did not. That's okay. When I quit that life, I was going into seventh grade, and in seventh grade is when I started drinking. And it was a way... Thank you. It was... It was a way for me to cope. I mean, I never drank alcohol because I wanted to go out and party and have fun. Like, from the beginning, it has been a way for me to cope with life. I did not like reality. I wasn't happy in reality. I couldn't make people happy in reality. Just it wasn't somewhere that I wanted to be. And so I did everything I could. And that continued through, you know, junior high. Like, I was the kid who brought... like Kahlua in the little bottles in our coffee mugs in, what, seventh or eighth grade, and be drinking Kahlua at school. And I have this actual image of this day where we went to PE and was trying to run around the track. It wasn't the track, it was inside the gym, and we were trying to run around, and me and my group of friends were drunk, so we couldn't, like, get around the gym, really, without falling over. It's kind of funny now, but... you know, but that was normal to me. You know, most of the people I was with, that's what we did. We got drunk and we did crazy things. And in high school, It didn't get any better. My alcoholism got worse. In high school, I found other ways to cope other than alcohol. I won't get too much into the drugs, but drugs were a huge part of my story. I liked drugs because I didn't get a hangover, if that makes sense, and I didn't puke. And so I would do those instead of drink. But every time I would try to quit drugs, I would drink like crazy. And so I don't think I was really sober very often from any sort of chemical, probably since I was about 16. I barely graduated high school as one of those alcoholics. I can't figure out, there's alcoholics in here that have somehow made it through college and was like alcoholics through college. Props up to you guys because I suppose it's probably not a good thing, but I couldn't like make it a semester. Like I just couldn't, I could not show up. Like when I did drugs and alcohol, that's all I did. That was my entire mind frame. That was my world. And so I couldn't do anything else. I got into a lot of fights and I got into funny, crazy things. But reality was too much for me. And like the reading talks about, you know how it's fun at night? And then when the sun comes up in the morning, you're kind of like, oh, crap. Like I still have to, you know, I still have to face today. And I got to the point where I couldn't handle that. And so I just couldn't be sober. My alcoholism took a turn when I was about 18. And I used to say I got kicked out. I think I say this every time I talk. But I used to say I got kicked out. But the reality was it was a crazy mix of my alcoholism, my ego, my being 18, the chaos at home. But my parents, I left. It was a combination of my parents kicking me out and me leaving. But I thought sleeping in my car was a better option than putting up with my mom's stuff. And so I started sleeping in my car because that was apparently the adult thing to do at 18. Shortly after that, you know, I needed money. And so a friend of mine suggested that I go work down at the local strip club. That would give me money. I could get in, get out, you know, whatever. That didn't happen. What I found in the strip club was a whole host of all sorts of other drugs that I've never tried before. And within 2 weeks, I was on pretty much every single one of them. I bounced around from drug dealers to other strippers. I mean, I just kind of lived all over, and that really became my life. Between about 18 and 21 is kind of a blur. I know some points around there, but it's kind of a blur. Where it basically ended up was I was picked up. My alcoholism led me to being picked up by a pimp, and I was trafficked to another state for prostitution. And I never thought when I was 7th grade, how old is that, 12-ish? 12-ish years old, that my alcoholism would take me to a place, to that place. But that's where my alcoholism took me. When I got sober, you know, I had tried several times. I tried to get jobs. I tried to do all those things. But like my alcoholism would not let me. I would have to face reality if I stopped using drugs. And I had no tools to face reality. That just was not something that I was taught, and it wasn't something that I had. So I would, you know how we do that. I'm never going to drink again. I'm going to wake up and I'm not going to do this again. I'm not going to do that again. And sure enough, I would be right back there within a very, very short period of time. I got to the point where, like, suicide was kind of my only option. I think a lot of people might be able to relate to that. I didn't know how to live sober, and I couldn't live high or drunk anymore. My drugs weren't working. I still had to look myself in the mirror, and I couldn't. There was one night, and this was very, very towards the end, where I was trying to put on my makeup to go to this is the night I actually called my doctor. I was trying to put on my makeup. I was in the club, and I was there before work, and I was trying to do my makeup, and I could not look myself in the face to even put my makeup on. I haven't thought about that in a long time. Ooh, that's annoying. Okay. And I couldn't put my makeup on, and so I pulled out some more lines so I could do some more lines to put my makeup on, and my doctor's card fell out. This was a family physician who I've known for years, and her card fell out as I'm like trying to cut up lines. And I called her at midnight, you know, from the club, and I was like, I can't do this anymore. I can't do it. I'm not going to live much longer. And, you know, I took that step to reach out. Now, reality set in the next morning and what I had done. And I was not happy with myself for doing that. Because all that could go through my mind is like, oh my God, they're going to lock me up, they're going to do this, and they're going to make me, like, I'm not an alcoholic. Like, I'm a drug addict, yes. But, like, they're going to make me not do all this stuff. You know, I'm going to have to go somewhere. I just freaked out, right? And I didn't want any part of it. And so I hid for, like, a week. And my doctor was calling me, my mom was calling me, and I just hid. I had an experience which triggered me to have a little bit more of a clarity, and I called her again, and I was like, all right, fine, you know, and she was like, okay, you're going into treatment on Saturday. It was a Saturday. So being the alcoholic that I am, I called my drug dealer / boyfriend. You know, we have, like, or at least us girls, some of us girls, we have, like, three boyfriends, and one's the drug dealer, and, like, one's, you know, you're getting something from each of them, but my drug dealer boyfriend, and I said, I'm going to detox, so let's give him something to detox. Like, that was my mind frame, right? It sounds really sick to me today, but that's just the place I was in with my addiction, and I did more drugs that night than I think I had done in my entire sobriety, and I don't really know what the motive was behind that. But needless to say, I missed treatment. I did not make it in that Saturday morning. I ended up having hallucinations that next morning, and for some reason that was enough to scare me. I never took those things. I didn't like those things as much as I liked not being in reality. And I called the treatment center myself, and they were like, okay, we can get you in on Thursday. And so Thursday, April 25th, 2002, I went into treatment. To say that I didn't use those few days before treatment is a lie. I used the night before, but I still managed to get into treatment. And so that was kind of the beginning of recovery for me. What treatment did for me, and again, I'm not going to get too much into treatment, but what it did for me was it introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not like you people. I did not want to come anywhere near a meeting. There was God all over the walls, and you passed a basket. So that was weird. Here's what was weird about that. I was a competitive athlete most of my life. So sponsorship, what does that mean in competitive athletics? You get paid. And so it was like a church where they're passing money, and you get sponsors. And, like, I couldn't figure it out. I thought people sponsored you to be sober. It was really weird. It took me a while to figure that out. But, yeah, I did. And I used to think AA was AAA. Like, I didn't know anything about AA before I got in. It was bad. I was 21. I didn't know what I was doing. But it introduced me to AA, and I was forced to go to AA meetings. So what that meant is I had to sit in these meetings while you people acted happy, and you people talked about God, and you people talked about this sobriety crap. And I tried not to listen the best that I could. The reality was is I actually started to like some of the things. Things started to sink in. I was forced to ask help in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys helped me. I came into the program with someone. When someone was nice to you, I would say, what do you want? Like, that was, nobody was nice to me unless you wanted something. And so I couldn't figure out why you people were nice to me. And I expected you guys to want paybacks at some point in the future. That never really happened, to say, thank goodness. And I just began to learn how to live life. I was shipped out here to the St. Paul. I did not know where Minnesota was on the map. I hate to admit that. I'm in grad school now, I promise. But I didn't. I thought it was where Michigan kind of was, so I wasn't sure. And I was pissed I was in the Midwest, and I had no intention of living here. And I had a plane ticket home and everything. I was going to come here for my sober house and leave. Again, that's not what happened. And I got a sponsor, and I started working the steps, and I had a sponsor who happened to be the DSM for District 8. at the time. So I got right into service work immediately. I learned more about the traditions, I think, quicker than I learned about the steps. But, you know, the traditions kept me, they kept me sober long enough to be able to trust somebody to be able to work the steps, if that makes any sense, right? She dragged me around everywhere. There's some people here that were in that home group with me, and it's really awesome. It's just crazy that I was 21 and crazy. I followed her around like a puppy dog. I did not like people. I still didn't like people. You guys still freaked me out, but she would be like, "We're going," and I would go. And I think that's what kept me sober. I mean, that's a lot of what kept me sober. Being in service, having to go to other meetings. I got put in a position where I had to coordinate volunteers. I was mad because I didn't want to go to more meetings. But in order to get you guys to volunteer, I had to go to your meetings. So I got to know a lot of people. My sponsor was slick. She was manipulative in that way. And, you know, that was really the beginning of my recovery. I spent the first 2.5 years not telling you guys everything. And I spent the first 2.5 years thinking that if you really knew me, then you wouldn't even want me in your AA meetings. And the big secret was that I was a prostitute. That was the big secret. I could not, like, I just could not face that. I could not face that in a meeting. I could not do that. And so that secret almost got me drunk, you know, and it was so melodramatic. I went into this meeting, right? So I switched sponsors, and I went into this meeting in someone's home, and I knew that this was the secret that was killing me, right? And so I go in this meeting, Bratz, is it still around? Is it still here? I don't think it's around. Bratz. And it was at somebody's house, and I just, like, they're like, "Honey, what are you doing? You know, how are you doing?" And I just started bawling. Like, all I could say was, like, "I was a prostitute." Like, it was really melodramatic and a little uncalled for. But it was a women's meeting. And I, like, it just was eating at me so much, and that I could say that. This is why I like women and men's meetings. I can say that now in a mixed crowd and be okay. But in early sobriety, I was not going to talk about that in a meeting. And I'm not going to in detail either. In any meeting, but I needed that women's meeting. I needed that space that was safe, that I could just say that out loud and just get a hug and be like, "We're not kicking you out. We're just not." And I got that. I got that from the women in AA. So a lot of my sobriety in the Twin Cities, it's like, where am I right now? Has been service work. I was on the district board. I was on the intergroup board. I've just done a lot of service. But the one thing that I want to say about service is that I got into this idea that for some reason I had to be a perfect AA, if that makes sense. And so I needed, I don't know, it was an ego thing or something, and I just needed to be a perfect AA. That meant that I was okay, is I was doing everything perfectly the way that apparently you guys wanted me to be. And so that meant being on every committee, being on, you know, all of this stuff. And there was a point in my sobriety where I was a paid employee at the intergroup office. I was living with another sober individual. I was on the district board, and I had like 4 sponsees. And the night of my birthday, I was at a bar. I didn't drink, but I had all of that service around me, all of that being around you people in AA, and I still found myself at a bar. So service isn't a substitute for working the steps in this program, and it's not a substitute for sobriety or for spirituality. I realized that I was caught up in ego, and I was caught up in perfectionism, and I was caught up in apparently some codependency that I have recently found out that I have. That was not a happy transition either. I was pissed I had to be in 2 12-step programs. But I won't get into that. But I was caught up in all of that stuff, like just all of this stuff, and I wasn't just being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to impress you guys and all that fun stuff, right? And it almost got me drunk. So, you know, I think from like that point on, I've really tried in my sobriety to practice these principles, not just in AA, but also in life, that so-called out there where all the normies are. You know, I get to, like, I learned how to live life outside of AA, and that's something that was a struggle for me, too. I'm going to fast forward to about a year and a half ago. And before I left for St. Louis, everybody I knew was in the program, everybody. I knew some people that weren't. You know, I went to school, I was in college, I was working, but I really didn't know anybody outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I did was in AA and all of that fun stuff. And when I went to St. Louis, I went to a completely new city where I knew absolutely anybody or nobody, and I had to leave my AA community. The people that knew me, the people that when I'm upset, all I have to do is just go sit in a meeting. And some of you guys, I only see like once a year when I lived here at some of these functions. But I knew that I could call you in a heartbeat. And I think there's a couple times I've done that where I haven't seen somebody in like 9 months, but I called them freaking out and they said, come over. But I had to go to a city where that wasn't the case. And I had to find that in St. Louis. And I'm still working on it. It's a challenge. I am brought up in Minnesota, so I think everything should be ran like it's ran in the Twin Cities. So I'm having to check my ego and not be the bleeding deacon and all that fun stuff. But I'm finding a community. But where I'm at in St. Louis, everyone I know is not in the program. The people I go to grad school with, the career that I'm working in. I have my core people that are in the program, but generally on a day-to-day basis, I don't see somebody that's sober every day, or at least that I know if they're sober or not. And I've had to, it's been an adjustment, but it's allowed me to realize that sobriety isn't just in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I've been in this program working the steps, doing the stuff that I can on a daily basis, and my part is to take it outside of AA, you know? We get to be of service outside of this program. We don't come in here, act holier than thou, have 15 sponsees, do 30 service commitments, and then go out and act like a complete butthead. It's about as far as I'll go with that one. Out in the real world, with the people that I interact with, I get to actually practice these principles outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. My AA program looks very different today than it did, and it's not a bad different, it's just a different, you know. I'm starting a nonprofit. I'm doing something else. I'm graduating from grad school next month, and it just looks very different today. I get to be of service in the community, and I get to practice these principles just in my day-to-day life of how I live life. And there's something that I'm just going to read real quick, because when I found this, I was freaking out a couple weeks ago. It was like a month ago. Because in St. Louis, it's still hard, because when I get stressed out or I'm in pain, I'm still building those connections where I feel safe. And so it seems it's more uncomfortable, I think, to be in pain there. And I happened to be sitting in a meeting because I freaked out and was like, I gotta go to a meeting. And I'm sitting in this meeting and I open my big book and there was this thing called Five Truths About Fear, and there was a woman from Como Park, before I left, gave this to me. And I just happened to open it and see it at the meeting, and it was perfect. And I'm just going to read it real quick. It says, the fear will never go away as long as I continue to grow. And she made a little annotation that said, that really made me mad, which I agree. The only way to get rid of fear is doing something is to go out and do it. The only way to feel better about myself is to go out and do it. Not only am I going to experience fear whenever I'm on unfamiliar territory, but so is everyone else. And then she said, that made me feel a little better, which is true. And pushing through fear is less frightening than living with the underlying fear that comes from a feeling of helplessness. And she said, how true. And then she wrote, on the other side of every fear lies freedom. And the space that I was in a month ago was in a lot of fear, a lot of fear. I'm in a new city. I'm graduating from grad school, which is weird. And I'm starting a nonprofit, and I'm working for this other nonprofit. And like everything that I've been doing in the last year is everything that is new to me. It's stuff I've never done before. And it's just uncomfortable. Like I'm in that uncomfortable new space. And I'm not good with uncomfortability. That's why I drink. I'm not good with fear. I'm not good with change, if that makes sense to anybody. Us alcoholics don't like change, apparently. And like that's the stuff I drank over. Like those are the character defects that affect my ability to live life on a daily basis. Not just in AA, not just about drinking. Alcoholism is the symptom, at least in my world, well, at least how I think. Alcoholism is the symptom, and alcohol was our solution. So alcohol's not the problem, it's us. It's the way we think, or I should say I. I don't want to speak for you guys. For me, it's the way I think, and it's the way I live life. And the way that I lived life was avoiding reality on a very regular basis. And the way that I live life today is still trying to escape that reality. Now, I don't get to use alcohol and drugs anymore to do that, so I do other weird little things, like be codependent. It's annoying. So I'm, like, working the steps around that. You know, I'm a workaholic, you know, I kind of jump into that. That's another way that I avoid reality, and so I'm working on balance. So it's about working these steps, it's about doing, for me at least, it's about doing steps 1, 2, and 3, I'm powerless, you know, God can restore me to sanity, and then I'll let God restore me to sanity, and then I get to look at my character defects that are interfering with me being able to live life. And once I identify those, I get to try to do what I can with them, right? I'm still not a big fan of amends. Not a big fan of that. I have an ego problem still, so I don't like to apologize. Unless it'll make you happy, if that makes sense. Because then I'll apologize too much. It just depends. That's where my codependency comes in. You know. So I get to work these steps in my daily life. Now, what's really funny is how much I implement the traditions in my life today as well. Things like primary purpose, things like no opinion on outside issues, like how in the world do we get to play with that in our own life? What's funny is like, I'm starting a nonprofit, I've said that 3 times, sorry. But I get to use the traditions to kind of run that agency. Like, Alcoholics Anonymous has been so ingrained in my life that I actually, like, try to do things the way of AA. Like, I really want to institute the 3 legacies on our board. I don't know how well that's going to fly. But living the best that I can under spiritual guidance, trying to do the best that I can to identify my character defects and then try to move past my character defects, like, all of that stuff. What's funny is that comes naturally to me. When I first got sober, that was not something that came naturally to me. But now I find myself doing things like, what am I powerless over? Like, oh, I can't control this. Have you prayed? You know, all of those weird things that we get annoyed with in the first year of sobriety, those are things that I tend to do. And that's where I get to practice these principles in all my affairs, not just in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm just really grateful for that. Do I even want to read this last piece? Yeah, sure. So the 10th step in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that big blue thing, if you don't have one, you might want to get one. That's a suggestion, by the way. Strongly suggestion. But on page 84, it talks about the 10th step. And we have these things called the promises, obviously. And so we have the 10th step promises as well. Go figure. I thought there was only the 9th step promises for a really long time until a fund sponsor pointed out that there's a promises for every step. But here's this, the 10th step. It says, and we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We seldom will be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this will happen automatically. We will see that our new attitude towards liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it. Neither are we avoiding temptation. This is the part that I really like. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor we are afraid. That is our experience. This is how we react so long as we keep fit spiritual condition. So there's two points to that that I forgot about for a while in early sobriety, was that as long as we keep in fit spiritual condition, there's a clause there. As long as we keep doing what it is that we need to do to stay comfortable in our own skin, if that makes sense. Also, we are neither cocky nor we are afraid. The last thing that I'll mention is I spent a lot of time in sobriety terrified, if that makes sense. I was that one that's like, if you put vanilla in the cupcakes, you will relapse, right? I was that one. I was the one who called my sponsor because the Advil label said you can only take two, and I had a migraine, and I needed to talk to her to see if my pain was real or if it was a manifestation to take more Advil. Like, I was that paranoid, crazy alcoholic, right? It's embarrassing now. My sponsor was like, honey, take some Advil. just take it. And I spent a lot of time... fear of doing something wrong that eventually I will drink. And I realized that if I'm so terrified of alcohol, I'm still in alcoholic behavior. That obsession over alcohol is still there for me. Now, I'm not saying there shouldn't be a healthy, understanding of the potential fatality of alcohol for us. I think that that's true, but I spent so much time just living in fear. And I think what the gift of being able to work this program and really being able to rely on God in a city where sometimes I feel like that's my only connection is the God of my understanding to the program, I found that that fear is still an obsession for me. And so living in serenity is not living in fear. It's just being okay. It's chill. Serenity is hard for me sometimes still, but when I feel it, it's awesome today. So I don't know. I'm really grateful to be here. I'm going to shut up. I didn't think I could talk for a half hour, and I think I went a little over. So I'm so grateful to you guys. It's awesome to be back in St. Paul to come see you, and thank you very much for my recovery. None of this would be happening in my life without the people in this room, so thank you.
Thank you, Katie. She talked a lot about service, and I'd like to take a few moments tonight to thank those of us who contributed in service this evening to make this meeting happen. So I'd start off with thanking Dale for reading How It Works. For Travis, our first speaker. For Judy, for sharing about the seventh tradition. Frank, for sharing about intergroup. My good friend Scott, who coordinated all the volunteers tonight, and I'd like to thank all the volunteers that helped out. Thank you. We had folks that were here early, they were shoveling, they were greeting, they were cleaning up, so I thank all of you for that. I'd like to thank Ruth for signing this evening. The board for all their hard work this year. To Katie for sharing with us her journey. But most of all, I want to thank all of you for being here this evening, because without you, we wouldn't have had a meeting. So thank you for your service. for being here. I'd like to invite all of you to join St. Paul Intergroup at Founders Day, which is happening next weekend. Our hospitality suite will be room number 226. And if you're there early Saturday morning, we'll be serving biscuits and gravy. So to come and check it out. We also have coming up the New Year's Eve party, which will be held in this facility starting at 7 o'clock. We'll have a speaker meeting. There'll be meetings going on in the step rooms here, and then there'll be a dance later on. So check out our website for more information on that and the other activities that come up. We have pretty much monthly activities that are hosted through St. Paul Intergroup. So will all who care to join me in closing the meeting with this responsibility statement followed by the Our Father.